This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. And Jonathan, I'm so happy that our Patreon dollars has helped us create this bunker in which we sit. Unfortunately, we didn't think about having solar power, so we are choking on paraffin fumes from our gas
lamps. Yes, because Eskom has been kind enough to load shed our bunker, located in a very secret location under a prominent mountain in the Western Cape.
So if this recording sounds a little bit different, please excuse us. Our studio is completely screwed thanks to Eskom not having enough electricity, so we have to record it elsewhere. But I mean, you know, despite the suffering,
we find ways to bring you your favorite podcast.
I mean, despite the suffering, the black market of podcasting is thriving and we are at the forefront of that.
Absolutely. And for those people overseas who don't understand what we're talking about, South Africa has gone down the path of socialism, and part of that is that one of the things the government owns when it comes to the means of production is electricity. And as a result, the government has run the electricity provider into the ground, and we are currently experiencing load shedding, which does sound quite obscene. It is, but not in the way you think. What that results in is rolling blackouts at different parts of the country for anywhere from 2 to 4 to 8 hours on a daily basis, and this is the reward we get for going down this rather storied path. And we're going to be talking to a guest today who's going to tell us all about it. Ramon, do you want to introduce our guest?
So our guest today is Christian Nimitz, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs in London.
Welcome to the show, Christian. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello.
So, Christian, following you on Twitter is quite a nice thing to do. It's my guilty pleasure, because you have this obsession with socialism for some reason. And but as far as I'm aware, socialism hasn't actually been tried properly yet. So why are you talking about this mirage all the time?
Yeah, I've heard that argument once or twice. In fact, as it happens, I've just finished writing a book on the history of this claim. Real socialism has never been tried, which is going to be published next week on Thursday the 21st. And the curious thing about socialism is that socialist experiments have always gone through a honeymoon period, during which they are widely and enthusiastically endorsed by plenty of Western intellectuals. So the Soviet Union in the 1930s was extremely popular among Western intellectuals. Maoist China was in the 1960s, and so on. And it's only when they either collapse or when their failures become more widely known that suddenly Western socialists try to redefine them. They look for reasons for disputing the socialist credentials of that system. So that's when they suddenly go, oh no, actually that wasn't socialism, now that we've had a second look at it. And after a couple of years, then it becomes a conventional wisdom that the system in question, whether it's the Soviet Union, whether it's Maoism, or now Venezuela being the more recent one, conventional wisdom becomes that that was never socialism, had nothing to do with it, and that it's just nasty liberal capitalists like me who claim that it was socialism because we use that as a way to defame socialism.
Well, perhaps we can start with a good old definition, because
yes,
we can't defame something that has a fixed definition. So let's stick to a fixed definition, and then we can talk about all these examples, all these failures, and sure, modern day examples, including the country we're sitting in.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have a particularly exotic definition of my own. I stick quite strictly to the dictionary definition, which says something like collective or state ownership of the means of production, or state-controlled economy, or some variation of that. Because the good thing about that definition is that that is perfectly value neutral and outcome neutral. So the dictionary definition of socialism doesn't say anything about gulags or show trials or mass executions, but neither does it say this will lead to a workers' paradise. It really just describes a way of structuring an economy, and what outcomes that produces then remains to be seen. But if you apply the dictionary definition, collective ownership, government ownership of the means of production, or government organizing economic activity, then according to that definition, the Soviet Union clearly was socialist. All of its allies in Eastern Europe clearly were socialist. North Korea is definitely socialist. Yeah. And some of the African countries that in the 70s and 80s that experimented with socialism were, as it says, as it said on the tin, socialist. And it is pretty clear then. And Venezuela today has moved at least a lot further into that direction. So they still have a relatively large private sector. It's just that that private sector is also indirectly controlled by the government. The government sets prices, the government controls exchange rates and so on. So this is not full-scale socialism, but certainly much closer to socialism than it was 20 years ago. By the way, it's not me making up definitions here. I really stick to the dictionary definition, and government ownership of the means of production, that really is what socialism is.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, although as we know, the dictionary is a tool of the patriarchy, so it can't really be trusted. But
and who funds the dictionary anyway?
True story. Who does fund the dictionary? great point. I think to elaborate and to advance on that point is that really, as long as you take that as a base definition, it doesn't matter how you get to the end point. It's always in a horrible fashion. So whether that's in the Soviet Union and you've got gulags, whether it's in Venezuela and ultimately people are eating their pets, whether it's in any of the other countries where it's inverted commas being tried and there's financial ruin and collapse of the private sector, small businesses, and just society in general, that always seems to be the end point of trying to institute this way of governing.
Yes, and it always happens in similar ways. It's not just that it always fails. It fails along predictable lines.
Mm.
And that's, of course, not a coincidence. That's because you cannot coordinate an economy without the price system. The price system is just absolutely necessary to collect information about conditions of supply and demand and to disseminate that information. The price system is just a way that a mechanism that allows us to respond to changes in the outside world. Let's say some resource is becoming scarcer or some other resource becoming more abundant. We may not know why that is, why that happened. We just see it reflected in changes in prices and we adjust our behavior in some way. And this happens in market economies all the time. And in that way, that coordinates our activities. That means there are neither surpluses nor shortages of something. We economize on things that are scarce and we economize less on things that are more abundant and use resources efficiently in that way. That's a mechanism that no socialist economy has yet been able to substitute. So market economies do this automatically. We don't even think about it. It's just something that we do all the time.
It's a function of the system.
Yes, absolutely. Whereas under socialism, you either have a planning board that directly sets prices. You don't have market prices at all. Or you have, like in Venezuela, something like market prices, but then the government overriding it and intervening and telling producers, no, you can't charge $3. It's maximum $2.50 or so. And that can be just as bad as fully state-controlled prices.
Yeah, it's a bit like there's a very famous essay or video called I, Pencil, made in the yes. 70s or 80s. I think it was an essay, actually. And it just describes how to make a pencil. And it involves tens of thousands of people in hundreds of countries doing what they are doing, and then miraculously at the end of everything you get a pencil, but the graphite is from Argentina, the wood is from Brazil, the ink or the whatever, the lead inside is from Germany, but no one has the intention of creating a pencil. They just intend to just make graphite or make wood or make paint, things like that.
Yes, exactly.
And others combine it and combine it and combine it, and then you get a pencil. But to try to control the way a pencil is made is practically impossible, because no one has that knowledge in and of themselves.
Yes, that knowledge is dispersed. That was also the argument that Hayek, the economist, made, that those people who are involved in the production of the pencil, they all know something about their circumstances of time and place, or at least of their own preferences, and they act upon it. But no single person, no single organization can combine and concentrate this dispersed knowledge that these millions of people possess and are acting upon. So you just have to give them the freedom and to let them do whatever it is that they're doing, and allow market prices and market institutions to coordinate that activity. But it's not something that you could steer or control.
Well, absolutely. But unfortunately, people do try to control it, even in what we call, you know, free countries like the US and others. I mean, there are still government impositions and nudges that try to regulate a market of sorts. But what do you think the intention behind trying to control the market is at the end of the day? Because is you know, do socialists intend to become totalitarians?
Usually not. Of course, you always get opportunists whenever a political movement is in the ascendancy. You always get people who join it last minute because they think this is the thing to do now. And that may explain a little bit. But if you think about the leaders of socialist revolutions in the past, those were usually people who joined the socialist cause when it seemed like a lost cause. And an opportunist for me is somebody who joins a promising cause. It's somebody who, when a party or a movement is already in the ascendancy, then jumps on the bandwagon thinking, oh, there might be a lucrative career in this. But actually, people like Lenin and Stalin in particular, they joined the predecessor of the Communist Party when it was an irrelevant fringe movement in the early 20th century, that when it had no hope of ever coming to power. And Lenin and Stalin therefore also spent most of their younger adult lives either in prison or escaping from the Tsarist police somewhere, in hiding in the underground, or in forced exile. Stalin in particular was exiled to Siberia, and those people really had joined that cause when it was absolutely not clear that they would ever rule such a large and massive country. They had no hope of coming to power initially. It was then something completely unforeseeable, which was the First World War and all the destabilization of that caused, and then a democratic revolution in the beginning of 1917, which then left an even more unstable government. But it was really conditions that nobody could have foreseen. This is not the way that opportunists act. Those people, as despicable as their actions were, you have to give it to them that they believed in their cause. And this is just the Soviet Union. You could say the same thing about plenty of other socialist leaders. So Fidel Castro and Che Guevara fought, of course, in the Cuban mountains as guerrilla fighters, and that's probably why we use that Spanish word for partisan fighters. Probably comes from them, that they fought this what seemed like a hopeless battle for a long time, and then came to power. The future leaders of the GDR of East Germany were people who were persecuted under fascism, under Nazism. So these were not people who joined a bandwagon, but they picked a cause early on and then stuck with it. So you, just from looking at the biographies of these people, you really can't claim that they were just after power. They did believe in the ideals of socialism, and they came to power not with the intention of just enriching themselves.
I think we often mention on the show that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And so it's often so-called good people with good ideas, good intentions, who support, inverted commas, good causes, who then go on to support socialism. So we can see it in countries that haven't embraced socialism, really, but there are socialist movements. United States is a good example currently. They seem to be going through a phase where there's a couple of politicians pushing very socialist ideas around their economy. I mean, Bernie Sanders in the previous presidential election, he was almost the nominee on the Democrat side. Arguably, if it hadn't have been Hillary Clinton and a bit of horseplay that went on there, Bernie Sanders would have been essentially a socialist running for the top office in that country, and he may very well have beaten Trump. So a lot of people think, you know, the ideas that come with socialism, well, we should all share, and we should all be nice and kind to each other, and so that's where a lot of the general public, who may not be very au fait with these ideas, they haven't read Hayek, and they haven't gone back into the history, and they don't truly know what Marx said and what Hegel said and what people have interpreted those things to mean since then. And it's interesting because often if you sort of say to someone who believes in a certain ideology, okay, what would you do if someone didn't agree with you and they said they were going to do their own thing? Then what would you do next? The answer with regards to socialism and socialists never seems to be, we'd just let them be. It always seems to be, we would persecute them. Now, they may not openly admit that, but that's how the system ends up. Do you think that is a feature of socialism?
That is a defining feature of socialism, because once you have a central plan in place, you cannot allow local autonomy. And that is the reason why socialist systems become more totalitarian over time. The Soviet Union, for example, was it depends on which aspects you're looking at. They were persecuting dissenters right from the start. That was baked into the Russian Revolution. But things like controlling the movement of people, that's something that only really started once they started rolling out the first five-year plan in the late 20s, early 30s. There's a reason for that. That's when they brought in this internal passport system where you needed a residence permit, where you could no longer say, I'm going to move from St. Petersburg to Moscow because I feel like it, where you needed a state permit. And that's, the reasons are perfectly clear. Once you have a five-year plan in place, then your labor is allocated somewhere. Some planner in Moscow has decided that you're going to work for this factory in that place and going to live in the house that they've allocated to you, and then you have to stay there. You can't just suddenly up your sticks and decide to move around, because then you would jumble the five-year plan. And that's why they have to have this power to enforce things. And that's why...
And then enforcement is through violence, usually. I mean, because that's the only way you can enforce these types of things against large populations.
Yeah, sure. And that's why a ban on immigration is then a perfectly logical extension of that. When you have in a market economy, immigration is not such a huge problem. We've seen in several Eastern European countries after socialism that they've had a large brain drain. And of course, that causes damage. They would probably be more prosperous if that brain drain had not occurred, or that they would definitely be more prosperous, but nonetheless they can sort of cope with it, and that's because they are now market economies, and the price system and the wage system can adjust to that. They have to pay more for certain professions because they know that otherwise they can't get them. Those people emigrate. And in a socialist system, you don't have that mechanism in place. So that's why you need internal immigration controls, because you don't have a market for housing, for example, where rents can adjust, and where if lots of people move from St. Petersburg to Moscow, where that rents would fall in St. Petersburg and rise in Moscow, that mechanism doesn't exist. It's all allocated by a central planning board, which is less flexible. So you have to impose restrictions on people, same on with the labor market. And it's even harder for a socialist economy to cope with emigration, because you have a plan, a five-year plan that is based on the labor force as it is at the time of the drafting of the plan. And then when you suddenly have large numbers of people deciding to emigrate, then your plan is basically worthless. And that's the reason why the Berlin Wall was built. It's not that they came to power thinking we're going to build a wall and divide the country and shoot everyone who's trying to leave. They tried for a while less extreme forms. They tried to appeal to people's consciousness, saying, don't you feel that you're part of our socialist community? You can't just go away. Or trying to portray life in the West as a hellhole, saying, do you really want to go there? Look at how horrible the West is. You're going to be exploited by capitalists and so on. When none of that worked, it's only when they've tried all the milder options first, that's when they said, okay, there's just no other way of doing this. Let's build a wall.
And that is one of the more terrifying aspects of socialism. Jordan Peterson had this great a speech about people that say, well, you know, if I was in charge, I would have done it differently. And he says that is so fundamentally untrue, because as you just mentioned, the feature is totalitarianism, and no amount of goodwill or, you know, charitable demeanor would change that in any way. The system itself corrupts you endlessly. And the only way for the system to work is through coercion.
Yes, I suppose a socialist would now respond, well, it's not about a nicer person being in charge. I'm not saying I want to be the next Stalin or the next Mao or the next Pol Pot, and I would be nicer. The argument would be that nobody should have that power. Nobody should be in the position that Stalin and Mao were in. It should all be dispersed and democratically controlled. It's just that there is no mechanism through which a large population can manage their affairs collectively. How is this supposed to work in practice? If you think of a country like Britain, we got 65 million people here. We all have different preferences, different priorities. How would we ever decide on a joint economic plan? You could try to gather the whole 65 million somewhere and have roving mics and have them all suggest what they want to produce or something, but it would never get anything done. It would be complete chaos. You can do this in a small group. That's why there's nothing wrong with a system like the Israeli kibbutz, which you could describe as small-scale socialism or voluntary socialism within a self-selected group. But that's because in a kibbutz you have maybe 100 or 200 people, and they have relatively simple economies. They specialize on mostly agriculture, or some of them now a bit more advanced industries, but nonetheless a relatively limited range. And these are people who all know each other. They see themselves as a community. And there it is feasible to gather the whole community and to discuss production plans for the next year. You can have all 200 gathering and just debating what they should do, whether they should plant more wheat or more rye next year. And that's perfectly possible to do that in that way. But it's just that once you have, firstly, a larger group, and secondly, a more complex economy, you mentioned iPencil, that's when this mechanism no longer works. You have to delegate things, and that's how you ultimately get something like a planning board or some technocratic elite making decisions, because it's just no longer feasible to control everything in a democratic way.
Yeah, we speak to a few socialists on this podcast, and the examples they give are often the kibbutz or like some cooperatives in South America that somehow have managed to produce dairy that they sell to corporations. And yet it works if you know the 200 people that work under you and you all have control over the shares of a cooperative. It's not that difficult to do. People do that every single day in their own families. But to impose that sort of system onto a massively complex economy is laughable, really.
I think the family example is the best one. I mean, it literally is from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. You know, the family is a sort of communist unit in a way. There's sort of central planning by parents usually. In a sort of functional unit, you would expect that one child's not necessarily favored that much over another. So the children get equal things, even if the one child excels particularly well at school and the other one doesn't. And that tends to work in those small units. But as soon as you try to replicate that and multiply it out, it becomes a complete failure. As you mentioned, I think if you got the 60 million odd people from the UK together, well, they can't even decide on Brexit. So, but if you manage to get them together, imagine the amount of time it would take you to get everyone to give their opinions, and then you'd never get them to agree anyway.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. If you look at how we're currently having massive political divisions because of Brexit, it can sometimes feel like a minor civil war. And imagine how bad it would be if we had to decide jointly on how much beer we should brew and what type of beer that should be. That would be an absolute meltdown. So these are things that you really do not want to politicize. Quite apart from the efficiency arguments that it would be inefficient and wouldn't work properly, it would also be a recipe for a constant social conflict. Because it would create a situation where everyone has to agree with everyone. And the good thing about a market economy, a decentralized economy, is that when people don't agree, they can do separate things. They can go their separate ways. You don't have to agree with everyone on everything. Sometimes you can just agree to disagree, and that would be that. But you can't do that in a socialist economy.
Well, I think the supermarket's the best example of agreeing and to disagree, right? Yes. Everyone, not everyone, but a large proportion of the world eats breakfast. But they all disagree amongst groups what the best breakfast is. Some eat Cocoa Pops or Rice Krispies. That's already a difference. Some want to eat muesli. Some want to eat some sort of fresh breakfast, fruit, perhaps. So, even in the smallest things and human activity, you get disagreement amongst individuals.
Yes, if you had a people's breakfast, that would be the recipe for a constant civil war. The close thing,
North Korea.
Yeah, well, but that's because they probably have an expert committee and they don't have debates about this. If you say something against the dear leader's decision of the people's breakfast, then you wouldn't be around for long. But I guess the closest thing to that we already have is the state broadcaster, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, where even though it is an institution that commands relatively high levels of approval, most people think the BBC is rather good, you often do get debates that, let's say, the BBC has someone on who promotes a right-wing point of view, and then you get left-wingers saying, this is a scandal, that person shouldn't be there, they shouldn't be given airtime. But then the same kind of thing can happen in the opposite direction, and it's because everybody feels that the BBC is somehow theirs, and therefore there's this intolerance to the BBC promoting a message that you don't like, which you wouldn't do with a private medium. If The Guardian, which is a left-wing newspaper, says something that I don't like, I'm not going to complain about it because that's what I expect. That's what The Guardian does. I would never expect it to
And you can promote. Unsubscribe if you happen to pay them. You have the choice.
Yeah, I sort of can't bring myself to do it. I hate read it as a form of self-trolling. But yes.
So let's talk about intellectuals for a moment. So I'm a big fan of watching like and lefties getting owned on YouTube, for example. It's one of my favorite pastimes. So a few last week, I believe, Andrew Neil spoke to Ken Livingstone, the ex mayor of London, and this man was making all sorts of excuses for the goings on in Venezuela and blaming sanctions. And Andrew Neil said, yeah, there were sanctions imposed 3 days ago, but the economy has halved in the last 10 years. So you can't blame the sanctions. And he refused to move away from sanctions, Western imperialism, and whatever.
American imperialism.
Yeah, essentially. Things like that.
He couldn't name a sanction. That was the thing. Andrew Neil kept pressing him, what sanctions are those? Can you name one? When was it introduced? What does it do? What's the scope? He couldn't do that. I see that now on social media all the time.
But how can someone like Ken Livingstone, who is, he's not an ignorant man. Why does someone like that, and there are many like him, would defend such a thing at all?
Well, it's a selective form of ignorance. It's not ignorance in the sense of simply not knowing, but in the sense of not wanting to know and deliberately editing what you see, selective seeing and unseeing and not seeing. So this the same person, Ken Livingstone, was on some radio program 2 years before where he said Venezuela is in crisis because they didn't kill the oligarchs. Now, this was, of course, before sanctions were brought in, and he needed a different excuse then. So back then, and this wasn't just him, this was also the Venezuela state or quasi-state broadcaster making that excuse. It's the former oligarchs are deliberately causing food shortages. They are stealing and hoarding all the food. And at that time, Livingstone was using that excuse. Then these sanctions came along and provided him with a new excuse. So now he's jumping to that. But 2 years ago, 3 years ago, he was also on TV, also on the radio, also talking about why Venezuela was in crisis, never mentioned sanctions. Of course, there's a good reason for that, which is back then there weren't any. Sanctions were only really brought in 1.5 years ago in the summer of 2017. That was when U.S. citizens were banned from purchasing Venezuelan government bonds. So before that, you had only personalized sanctions. You had individual asset freezes for selected members of the regime, which meant they could no longer travel to the U.S. They could no longer invest there. And that is a bad thing if you are one of those people, then you will feel the effect of those sanctions, but it could not possibly have an effect on the wider economy. If you just sanction 12 people, then how is that supposed to affect the GDP of the country or food supply or revenue of exports or whatever it is? It's just completely impossible. Yeah. So sanctions were really, in a meaningful sense, only brought in 1.5 years ago. And by then, the Venezuelan economy had already been in free fall for 3.5 years, had already shrunk by a third.
Yeah. Let's talk about Venezuela. We've mentioned it quite a bit. It really should be the last example of an attempt at socialism, even though, the no true Scotsman fallacy will, of course, be raised. Everyone should be looking at that and going, right, it is time to abandon this ideology. It is time to move away from it completely and to never, ever go down this path again. Yet we do have people like Ken Livingstone defending it. I haven't heard Jeremy Corbyn defend it recently, although he did it in the past, and he certainly hasn't come out against it. You've got the usual
until
suspects.
Until
4 years ago. You've got the usual suspects in every country, pretty much, where we've got our own useful idiots in South Africa, politicians.
Well, our government sided with Maduro.
Yeah, our entire government, from foreign policy perspective, has sided with Maduro and not the other interim president, so to speak, Guaido.
Guaido.
So, thanks for that. You've got people clearly picking the wrong side when the evidence clearly goes against them. Do you want to just run through a quick timeline of how Venezuela collapsed from being essentially one of the richest, or if I'm not mistaken, the richest South American country 20 years ago, roughly.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I've got a Venezuela chapter in the book which goes through that in chronological order. And I'm trying to show in parallel, firstly, how this economy collapsed, the economy that was once so prosperous, as you said, but also how Western intellectuals have been talking about Venezuela at different stages, this cycle of enthusiasm, then disowning after a period of silence. So what happened was that Venezuela was a petrodollar economy long before Chavez. That's that was already the case before Chavez was even born. And they had their golden age in the 1960s and 70s, the 70s in particular because of the oil price boom of that period. But that's what made them rich on the one hand, but that's also what determined the structure of their economy. It made it, turned it into a patronage economy. So you had to state with lots of revenue from the oil trade. Oil was not nationalized yet at the time. It was done by private companies, but the Venezuelan state collected large royalties, and they used that money to set up development agencies, regional development agencies, in that way owning large parts of the was nominally the private sector, having large public sector works, projects, and employed directly or indirectly a large proportion of the workforce. It became a very state-centered, state-dominated economy. So that was already true in the 70s. Now, this all worked perfectly well as long as the oil price was as high as it was in the 70s and constantly rising. The problem started when oil prices hit a peak in 1980, and then fell for nearly two decades. And during that period, Venezuela was still more prosperous than its neighbor countries. It was still prosperous by regional standards, but it had an extremely volatile economy. You could have fantastic growth rates in one year and then a deep recession in the next year, and indicators like poverty were all over the place, rising, falling. It was all a bit chaotic. And the trouble was that the population had got used to high levels of public spending, which were now no longer affordable. So the state borrowed and printed money. That's why budget deficits went up, inflation went up. They had to be bailed out at some point by the International Monetary Fund in the 80s. And but you had this political culture of resistance to economic reality, where you would have one government saying, we need to make adjustments, we are no longer the oil-rich country that we once were, or well, that same amount of oil, but they would no longer get the same amount of revenue for it. We have to live within our means now. And you would have some opposition politician saying, no, that's not true, it's a lie, you're doing this just out of sadism, or because you're bad people, and you had this populist grandstanding. And it was in this environment that Chavismo developed. So Chavez was initially not a socialist. He was just a left-wing populist who railed against the country's oligarchy and so on. And he then came to power, elected in 1980, took office in 1999, elected in 1998 and took office in 1999. And that was the beginning of a massive oil price boom again, which lasted until 2013. And that meant that he could fulfill his promises. If that hadn't happened, if oil prices had stayed constant or fallen further, then we would probably never have heard the name Chavez. He would have been just like the presidents before him, a bit of populist grandstanding, some initial spending programs, but then being forced.
He would have run out of other people's money sooner.
Yeah, exactly. And the name would never have become a household name. We would have no idea today who Chavez was. But since it coincided with this oil price boom, he could fulfill his promises and became extraordinarily popular. And he did just that for a while, just spending lots of money, which any other president would also have done. But then after a couple of years, he started to go down a more explicitly socialist route. So he started to especially control prices and intervene more heavily with the state-owned oil company. So he didn't nationalize it, he inherited it. He just kicked out the minority private investors and took it over completely, turned it into his personal political plaything, turned it into a government propaganda bureau and used the funds to spend on his own pet projects. And once he started controlling prices and exchange rates, the usual problems that you would expect started to manifest themselves. You had shortages of some goods in the supermarkets. So what he did then was, rather than taking his initial interventions back, he railed against the private sector actors in question. So they're trying to undermine me, they're sabotaging me, these are imperialist agents, and threatened to expropriate them. And a couple of years later, he started actually doing that, especially in his third term, his third and last term.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. That seems like the blueprint of what our government is doing absolutely. At this very moment.
Word for word, almost.
Except here, there's a racial tinge to it. So, I mean, if you're not aware, the African National Congress controls what is the government of South Africa, and they now want to nationalize farmland.
Expropriated
without compensation to give to poor black farmers who were oppressed during the times of apartheid, of course. And if you're against this policy, you are an imperialist white settler who should go back to New Zealand for some reason, and
or Europe,
most especially to the Netherlands, which were the first Dutch settlers in 1652. So this model of socialism is quite well known to us here in South Africa.
Yeah. Do you want to carry on what Chavez then did when he had his third term and started expropriating everything?
Yeah. Well, what happened then was that in those nationalized industries, productivity soon collapsed. And of course, he scared away private investors, both international ones. So he also expropriated one Spanish company, which was involved in, I don't know, either around the oil or doesn't matter. Either way, he just signaled to private investors that he was willing to ride roughshod over the rule of law, except no limits on private property in particular. And that is how the economy became even more oil dependent. It was an oil dependent economy before, but it became more so during the Chavez years. And that was because he destroyed the alternatives. If you signal to investors that you don't respect private property rights, well, what's going to happen? Of course, nobody's going to invest anymore. And then you're only left with that state-controlled oil sector. When he came to power, oil revenue accounted for something like 3/4 or a bit less of Venezuela's exports. Right now, it's virtually 100% of it. They export nothing else. And that is because this policy of random expropriations destroyed the alternatives. And that's what happened. That was the big difference between what was going on before, where the Venezuelan state was always interventionist, but pre-Chavez, it stayed broadly within the rule of law. It was not a banana republic. It was a place where you could invest and where you had an independent court system and property rights and legal procedures were more or less guaranteed. And that's what changed under Chavez, and Maduro is now carrying on with this. So when socialists now say, oh, that's a bad example, it's only collapsing because they're too oil dependent, but if they had diversified a little bit, it would all have been fine. No, it happened for a particular reason that they became even more oil dependent. And that was exactly the fact that they clamped down on the alternatives. So Chavez and Maduro made the Venezuelan economy far more oil dependent than it ever was before them. And that was a big part of their socialist program, this disrespect for private property rights. And that was also what their Western cheerleaders liked particularly about them. Exactly the fact that they would not get bogged down in legal details, that they would just say, we don't like what you're doing, we're expropriating you. And that's what they were cheered on for by plenty of Western commentators. For example, Owen Jones, who is a left-wing journalist here in Britain, talked about how they expropriated a building company. I don't know what exactly it was, it's cement or something, which didn't want to cooperate with the government on its housing program, on the terms dictated by the government. So Chavez just said, okay, that's it, you expropriated. And this commentator praised that action in particular, the fact that they... So the message was, well, finally there's a government that stands up for the people. No more sucking up to business leaders. No, just saying, you either cooperate or we expropriate you.
Yeah, and if you look at the headline from Venezuela, since about perhaps 2006, I've been following this timeline very interesting. So 2006, 2007, oh, they want to expropriate farmland because there's too many big farmers, right? They're creating a monopoly, a cartel of their own. So we're going to expropriate farmland, give it to poor farmers in smaller parcels, of course. And then 2010, okay, now we need to take away guns from citizens. And then you go to 2015, they're going to expropriate something else. And then you go to 2017, they're going to expropriate something else. And now you're stuck in a situation where 3 million people have left and your tax base is shrinking, so you don't want people to leave. So you put huge tankers across the border with the neighboring country. I believe it was Brazil or Colombia.
Colombia,
where you now basically make it impossible to leave the country while people get... while people starve and, you know, perform great feats of weight loss thanks to the Maduro diet. It's all rather evil. And to suspect that most or quite a few Western intellectuals with their Wi-Fi, internet and Starbucks coffee and iPhones praise this sort of thing is, I can't be too polite, but it's rather disgusting.
Yeah, absolutely. Although the support has fallen more silent in the last couple of years. But it was specifically when it was not yet visible how much damage this would cause. The problems that we associate with Venezuela today, the shortages in particular, that started pretty much just after the introduction of price controls in the early, mid-2000s already. So that isn't new. But back then, initially, they still, it didn't really matter that much because they had all this high oil revenue. So the state could itself then provide those goods that the private sector no longer would provide. And it still seemed like a prosperous economy for quite a while. It was only when oil prices then fell again in 2013, fell back to a more normal level, that it became clear that it was all built on sand. And that's when a lot of the Western supporters suddenly fell curiously silent. It was from about the mid-2000s until 2013-14, you had lots of prominent Westerners supporting Venezuela quite enthusiastically. Journalists, academics, politicians. The story then was they're building a new kind of socialism, and this time is going to be completely different. This will have nothing to do with Soviet socialism, with Maoism, with North Korea, any of those other examples. This is a completely new chapter in the history of socialism, and this time they will get it right.
Yeah. Sorry, you were saying?
And then it stopped abruptly in 2014. You had this long period of silence. And then about 2 years ago, you had the first voices saying, oh, actually, Venezuela wasn't really socialist.
Yeah, of course not. And I think what's interesting to me is the examples we've had in the past, which you've mentioned, but more concerning is that people are not dropping this idea. And so when you say to people, okay, well, you know, what about the Soviet Union? What about Mao? What about Cuba? What about Venezuela? When you point out these examples and you show them how defeated this ideology is, what they will say to you is, yes, but Norway, or yes, but the Nordic states. And those are socialist states, and we know on this podcast those are not socialist countries, actually. But I'm interested to hear your take and how you answer that when it gets thrown at you.
Yes, I would simply say, I would go back to what we talked about earlier. Stick to the simple dictionary definition of socialism. Socialism means government ownership of the means of production, and that is not what's going on in the Nordic countries. They have, Sweden in particular, had a period of privatization in the 90s that was almost comparable to what happened in Britain in the 80s with Thatcherism. It's just that they have a more pragmatic political culture. You did not have an ideological war around this. You had a government that just silently, without much fuss about it, privatized a lot of state-owned companies. And that's why we don't associate Sweden with privatization in the way in which we associate Britain or America with privatization. But basically, there is no massive difference in economic policy. It's not a completely different economic model. These are market economies. They just combine a dynamic market economy, a dynamic private sector on the one hand, with high taxes and high levels of income redistribution. And that's something that, as a free market here, would not be my first choice, but that's something I can live with. I just think even that is something that doesn't travel that well outside of Scandinavia. They can afford higher taxes and higher levels of welfare provision than most of the rest of the world, or pretty much anywhere else in the world, because these are societies with very high levels of social cohesion and social trust. In other places,
Sorry, Christian, because that's the theory I've heard. So someone once told me, and I can't remember when, basically the more diverse a society, the more freedom you actually need, the more decentralization you actually need, the freer the market needs to be, because, especially from a state level, because it's very difficult to have social, not cohesion, agreement on policies, because they affect people in different ways. But if you have a country like the Nordic countries, until 2015, that is, that are fairly homogenous, share the same cultural values, are fairly small in terms of population, it is much easier to tread that fine line of relatively free market, but a very high taxation welfare rate. But to replicate that elsewhere is practically impossible.
Yes, you can see that in the Nordic countries, you have, for example, even though there is a grey economy. There are people who are avoiding taxes, let's say builders who do a building job for cash in hand and not declaring it. That does exist there, but it is much smaller than you would expect given the tax burden. So those sorts of indicators show you that this is a population that is willing and prepared to pay high taxes, whereas the Mediterranean countries, for example, even though they're in absolute terms, the size of their government is much smaller, they have a much larger grey economy. They don't have the same level of social cohesion. People are less willing to pay the taxes. And that's why Scandinavia can get away with things that wouldn't work anywhere else in the world. But even then, this is just about the size of the public sector and the generosity of the welfare system. Proper socialism in the sense of having the state plan the economy, set prices, set production targets, that would not work in Scandinavia either. This is something that fails strictly for economic reasons. Even if you have a population that is willing to, that is very socially cohesive and willing to go along with it, you still would have the eye pencil problem, the coordination problems. You, the central planners would simply not have enough knowledge to be able to plan an economy. And that's why when Sweden in particular tried to move further into the direction of proper socialism in the 80s, as opposed to just a big state, when they tried to intervene more heavily with corporate governance structures and try to tell private companies what to do, that didn't end well for them either. So this type of genuinely socialist policies doesn't work in Sweden any more than it would work anywhere else. So you can have a bigger state in Sweden, but you can't have socialism there either.
But even then, I think what's quite interesting is, you know, as you mentioned, those countries are market economies. They have some of the lowest corporate tax rates in the world, even though private tax rates are very high. So if I'm not mistaken, I think their tax rates are in the region of about 15%, which are amongst the lowest in the world, besides for obviously the tax havens. But it still remains to be seen long term if their socialized welfare systems can survive. You look specifically at something like healthcare, where there the government is running the healthcare system and they are centrally planning the healthcare system. And as healthcare becomes more complex, as the number of procedures that need to be performed becomes more complex, become you know, more advanced, more expensive, but they, you know, obviously do come down over time, but there's just more healthcare that can be provided to a population at a greater cost. Whether in fact there is enough money to go around to cover this, I mean, I would argue that the UK is a good example that this is starting to fail.
Yeah, I think it's never been particularly successful here. It's just that previously we wouldn't really compare healthcare across countries, and it wasn't so clear that the British system was behind others. But as far as the time series go back, it's not that there was ever a golden age. I think Britain has always been fairly poor in terms of health outcomes.
Do you want to just elaborate a little bit? Because I know you do have a background in sort of the healthcare side of things, and why these sort of socialized healthcare systems are failing. We've got a government here looking at introducing a national health insurance, which is essentially modeled on several countries, notably some of the Nordic countries, and is meant to replicate the NHS to some extent. What's the reason why these systems also end up ultimately collapsing over time?
Well, it's the same reasons as in any other sector. You central planners lack the knowledge, and you need competitive mechanisms in healthcare as much as anywhere else. It must be clear from the perspective of a healthcare provider that their economic survival depends on whether customers are happy with what they're receiving or not. And if customers can go elsewhere, then you have a very different situation than having a guaranteed customer base of people who can't move away. Now, that doesn't have to mean that that healthcare cannot be largely or even fully publicly funded, or that you cannot make sure in other ways that that poor people can get healthcare. But what I'd argue is simply that if it's access to healthcare that you're worried about, and I'm guessing that would be an issue in South Africa probably, then the way to do that is not to have the government take over the provision of healthcare. You just need to make sure that that your private system that covers everybody. I mean, that's if you compare Britain to the insurance systems that you get in other parts of Western Europe, because not many places have an NHS type system. For example, the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, and Belgium, they had a private insurance system long before the state did anything. And at some point, the government just decided that they wanted to make sure that everybody is covered by the system. And therefore, they introduced premium subsidies. They made sure that health insurers cannot discriminate on the basis of health status. And
the prices went up, I would guess.
They did, yes. But they managed to achieve universal healthcare systems nonetheless. And within what is still broadly a market-based framework. So you still have private insurers, private healthcare providers. You have a market of sorts. You just have the government making sure that everybody can take part in that market.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Christian, just to end off this podcast, and it's been really illuminating, even for me, who I thought, you know, new things. I've learned quite a bit. So socialism always stands up, supposedly, for the poor and the oppressed. What, ideally, if someone had to ask a capitalist like us or like you, what does the free market do for the poor and oppressed? How does it help them in a way that perhaps other systems do not? If you had to have like a short, you know, statement to someone, how would you explain the value of the free market in helping the poor and oppressed?
Well, I would simply look at the track record of market economies and of economies that are liberalizing. On the whole, things are getting a lot better globally. There's plenty of data that shows how poverty is falling around the world. Just over the course of my lifetime, I was born in 1980, from then to today, extreme poverty on a global level has fallen from more than 40% then of the global population to less than 10% today. That's a massive improvement, biggest ever in human history. And that is not something that just happened randomly. It was particularly concentrated in places that liberalized their economies. So much of it, of course, has occurred in China. And not coincidentally, that was during the time that they, relatively speaking, liberalized their economy, went away from the economy they had inherited from Mao Zedong, a fully socialist economy, to this hybrid, half-socialist, half-capitalist system that they have now. And this is a pattern that you can see around the world. India was also a heavily protected economy before the 1990s, then liberalized a little bit, starting from a very restrictive level, but nonetheless. And poverty has also dropped a lot since then. And you get this association all the time that if you look at things like economic freedom, the degree to which an economy is market-based, capitalist, can be measured within limits. There is the Economic Freedom of the World Index, which tries to measure the degree of market orientation in an economy on a scale from 0 to 10, where 0 would mean pure communism, 10 would be pure capitalism. And you can really see that places that get closer to capitalism, even though none of them go there all the way, even though none of them get a 10 out of 10, but some get 8 point something, 7 point something. Those are the sorts of places where you want to live. That is places like Hong Kong, Singapore, Switzerland, and then to a lesser extent, New Zealand and Canada, the places where people want to migrate to rather than places that have to worry about emigration. And it's in those places that the poor are are best off, even though they might not be as rich as some of their fellow countrymen. But I would much rather be poor in Switzerland than relatively rich in Venezuela.
Yeah, absolutely. Christian, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and just really a masterclass in all the problems with socialism and how to approach a lot of these arguments that people might find themselves getting into.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Enjoyed it.
No, well, thank you very much, Christian. Thankfully, the local government won't go down that same path. They will find the error of their ways soon enough, I suppose. While we are talking to you in the dark, because electricity is not on for 4 hours. But nevertheless, Christian, thank you so much. And I hope whoever does fund you, increases the budget, because it's very important that you're out there to mock the intellectuals who approve of dangerous and disgusting things.
I do.
Great. Thank you so much, Christian. And we hope to chat to you sometime in the future. And good luck with the book. Do you want to just plug your book quickly, your social media, so people can find you?
How do I do that?
Well, your book, I assume, is going to be available on Amazon, or whereabouts can people...
No, the book will be available here on the IEA website. That's www.iea.org.uk.
Great.
And you can download it for free. You can also get it on Amazon or plenty of other online retailers, but why not get it directly from the source?
A capitalist giving something away for free. Jesus. This whole hour...
Unpriced. Free at a point of use.
Perfect. Christian, thanks so much, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Cheers, eh?
Well, there you go, Jonathan. A blueprint for the EFF and the ANC to follow.
Well, not only a blueprint. I mean, they're already on that blueprint, as you mentioned. But some of the stuff Christian was saying, I was just sitting here thinking, we are mirroring Venezuela. We are. It's almost like... We're doing exactly what they did. We're just, you know, either 6 or 8 years behind them, depending.
Right, but it's a, as you said, it's a familiar path. Mm. You nationalize some things, you take away rights, you take away guns, and then you have complete control on the economy by the state, and you prevent people from leaving because it interrupts the plan. So I hope that the listeners understand that. We let Christian speak for a very long time, but that is to show the reasons why you should be rather worried about your future.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're in doubt, I do hope the past week of power outages, load shedding, has made you a little bit more aware that the policies that government talks about at elective conferences and the things that people talk about on this podcast, the things that people tweet about, things that people at the IRR, you know, that terrible think tank, write about. These are not philosophical ideas alone. These are things that are happening and are affecting our lives directly. And we really need to be more aware of them and fight against them as best we can.
Indeed. And it's an indictment on people like us to actually, you know, we haven't fought the ideas well enough. We started this podcast to fight the ideas, and hopefully, thankfully, it has, you know, reached a wide audience. But you need to fight the ideas as well. If you can't fight them, you must fund them. So on that note, send us money.
Yes, absolutely. You can support us on PayPal. As always, we are still on some other less likable platforms for the time being, and are developing a new way for you to support the show. But any way you can, we'd really appreciate it. Obviously, as always, your downloads are very supportive and helpful. If you review the show, if you're listening on iTunes or Google Android Store, that would be great.
And even if you don't want to pay on PayPal or things like that, send an email, info@renegadereport.co.za. We'll happily send you banking details and a lovely email to say thank you. Because you're fighting the battles of ideas, you're fighting for an investment in the future of South Africa. We're doing our small part. We are going to increase that small part to hopefully a medium part in the very short term. But we are not past the post.
Mm.
There's not hope. I don't like the word hope. There's lots of work to be done, but don't think that this is an inevitable conclusion. There's still a lot of space to maneuver and work to make South Africa, great.
Make South Africa great again? Just great?
Not again, because that would be racist.
All right. So as always, follow Ramon on Twitter @RomanKavanagh, myself @Jonathan_Witt. On Facebook, The Renegade Report, @Renegade_Report. Not Facebook, on Twitter, and on Facebook, the group and the page. You can, of course, find our guest this week on Twitter as well. He is Christian Nimitz. That's K_Nimitz, NIEMIETZ. Thank you, as always, for listening. We really appreciate it, and we'll catch you next time. Cheers. We'll be right back.
This is CliffCentral.com.